Today on Against the Grain, why has the term complicity become so ubiquitous in recent years? Are we all complicit in the system that we live under? What use or uses does the notion serve? These are questions that legal scholar Francine Banner poses. She makes the argument that the term bears different meanings, sometimes holding the powerful to account, and other times looking for someone to blame, rather than focusing on systematic change. She considers the shifting modern use of complicity, shaped in part by problematic scholarship on the uncaring bystander, and sees parallels in how the legal system severely penalizes those for even peripheral involvement in crimes. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The term complicity is everywhere in an era of highly visible wrongs and attempted reckonings. But scholar Francine Banner argues that complicity means different and sometimes contradictory things. The complicity of corporations or states, such as in abetting genocide, represent one kind, illuminating the interconnecting web of systems of injustice. But there's also the complicity of individuals who are seen to enable the wrongdoings of others, sometimes with their silence or inaction, often leading to public shaming and ostracization without rehabilitation, frequently echoing the punitiveness of our legal system, which comes down hard on purported accomplices to crimes who are disproportionately poor people and people of color. She makes these arguments in her book, Beyond Complicity, Why We Blame Each Other Instead of Systems, which is published by UC Press. Banner is professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and her many books include Crowdsourcing the Law, Trying Sexual Assault on Social Media. Francine, I wonder if you can begin for us by describing the two broad ways that complicity is deployed, one which you think is useful and one which you think is not.
I find complicity fascinating because it is such a prevalent concept in both law and in everyday discourse. And as you mentioned, I do see complicity as having both positive and negative aspects in both law and in society. On the negative side, as we know, the accusation that a person is complicit can be very isolating. An allegation that someone did or failed to do something that enabled wrongdoing or harm can cause stigma. And in the all too common court of public opinion that takes place today on social media, there are often no standards of proof or no good path to defending against allegations. Complicity doesn't have an opposite. There is no uncomplicit. In the book, I provide examples of social media influencers who might be posting content on TikTok or Instagram for entertainment purposes. Maybe they're talking about cosmetics or grocery shopping. And then they're called out for posting something that's perceived to be perhaps racist or sexist, or often called out for staying silent in the face of not taking an active position in a war or a crisis. To be called complicit can really be a damning allegation. And again, the evidence for this is often very hazy. But I do see something positive here. The prevalence of complicity, I think, suggests we're at a time when many of us are reassessing our own and other people's relationship to the larger world. There's a literary theorist whose work I admire, Michael Rothberg, who identifies that today there's something like a political space that's opening up between victims and perpetrators. And I think complicity can be said to occupy that space. It's how we discuss that area in between not quite guilty and not exactly innocent.
Right, and we'll explore that murkiness more as we go on. I wanted to ask you, where do you think the modern sense of complicity comes from? We've seen its acceleration in recent years, but how should we understand its origins?
I discuss what I call the complicity moment as a product of the overwhelming and often unpredictable risks that we seem to be facing today. And I'm sure I don't need to name all of these. The COVID pandemic, which seems to have become endemic, disinformation, climate change, and of course, the wars that we see erupting across different geographies. Something else that I see happening is, as a society, we're identifying problems that have existed for a long time, and that clearly anyone who was experiencing knew as problems, systemic racism, sexual assault and harassment, as risks. Something that the Black Lives Matter and Me Too social movements have done is to begin to instill, I think, a more widespread recognition that something like racism or sexism isn't just something that hurts individuals who experience that as a target or victim, but these are problems that hurt us all, not just metaphorically, but socially and economically. Historian Adam Tooze uses a term that I find appropriate to refer to this time. He calls this an era of global polycrisis, when we're facing economic, sociopolitical, and climate risks that are increasingly diverse and increasingly intersecting. It's important, I think, to realize that there's a difference between a danger and a risk. A danger is something tangible, like we're running away from a dinosaur. A risk is something that we can't always see with the human eye, can't necessarily measure. And risks are constructed for us by what we see in the media or what we hear from experts or politicians. A significant thing about most of the risks that we're facing today is that they are created by human beings. A second important thing is that it is not usually one person that's causing these. Our problems are so complex that they can't usually be traced to one source. And a third important factor is that somebody has to interpret and control risks going forward. They can only be minimized if humans can be inspired to take some kind of action. This puts us in a situation where, across a number of issues, we're looking to politicians, experts, and each other, and we're often pointing fingers, asking who is responsible, what do we do next, and who's going to decide this?
Indeed. And those sort of complicated lenses that we're looking through obviously accentuate the ways that complicity as a concept is deployed. Now, you argue in your book that we can find uses of the notion of complicity going back to the 1300s, but how would you trace the way in the 21st century we have come to understand the term complicity? You know, there's obviously a legal component to the notion of complicity, and then there's this broader political or philosophical notion of complicity. How can we trace that history?
So I explore complicity as a product of really rapidly changing definitions of injury and violence that over the past few years have really expanded to include not just physical harms, but most of us understand violence to be much broader, to be emotional, psychological, and clearly systemic. It used to be that we would identify a perpetrator in the case of a criminal act, and that would be the end of the story. The person would be arrested, they'd hopefully be convicted, and justice would be done. Today, conversations look very different. Once we identify a risk of harm, we generally identify that as not just emanating from an individual. There's not just one bad apple in many cases. If we look at, for example, institutional sexual assault or harassment that's occurring, or a problem like racism or climate change, if we identify one bad actor, then immediately we are faced with coming to terms with the way in which other individuals, institutions, and often we ourselves could have enabled that action, even through some kind of minor behavior. In its positive aspects, we're using complicity to hold corporations, states, and institutions to the fire. It's a fear of being deemed complicit, for example, that prompted corporations like Starbucks or McDonald's to shutter their retail operations in Russia after the 2022 invasion of Ukraine. Complicity is the argument that institutions like the Kennedy Center or the Mayo Clinic have used to return hundreds of millions in what they would call tainted donations from Russian oligarchs, but also from other sources, accused sexual harassers or people who have been accused of racist behavior. Complicity is prompting corporations to enter into settlements with grieving families in response to the opioid epidemic or the wake of school shootings. And so these emerging understandings are, I think, really inspiring more pro-social acts we see from institutions and individuals. The word complicit, it is not new. It's been used since the 1300s to describe a range of behaviors that are sometimes illegal, but often just immoral or unethical. St. Thomas Aquinas, for example, highlighted ways in which persons might be culpable as non-direct perpetrators. So, as we look back, it has a very rich history. But along the way, complicity really has evolved.
One central moment in contemporary history around complicity is obviously to do with the horrors of the Holocaust and World War II, where blame would be laid and who is accountable beyond the obvious leaders. How did the period coming out of World War II shape the Western notion of complicity, which remains with us to this day?
Obviously, anyone who is going to write about complicity, particularly in a social context, clearly is writing in the shadow of the Holocaust. And as we know from contemporary events, the past clearly is present. Something that really interests me out of the Holocaust that is relevant to the conversations going on today is the ways in which our reflection on the Holocaust, both in the immediate aftermath and scholars' reflection later, really changed perspectives on human behavior, both in terms of the extent of the evil that could be done by perpetrators, but especially the harm that could be done by bystanders. I use in the book literature some research by Victoria Barnett, a religious studies scholar, who identifies the idea of the active bystander as really an outgrowth of the Holocaust research that took place in the 1960s and 70s. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, most researchers who were looking at human behavior tended to ignore the roles of citizens of Germany and nearby nations in genocide. Many of the researchers assumed ordinary people were just following orders of the state. And when we look at research done by social scientists in the period, for example, Stanley Milgram's studies on authority, a lot of that research seeks to explain why human beings might do horrible things to other humans if told to do so by an authority figure. But as we start to move beyond the immediate post-Holocaust, post-World War II period and into the 60s and 70s, more research starts to be done that looks more at the role of ordinary people as agents and to question whether, you know, even within very oppressive environments, ordinary people, everyday citizens, might have made choices that were impactful, that were not just merely following orders of the state. And scholars began to sift through records and identify and categorize different levels of collaboration by ordinary citizens and began to view witnesses to the war in a way that granted them a lot more agency and to explore how patterns of behavior by everyday people might have aided and abetted the crisis. While in the immediate aftermath of World War II, the general assumption was that average people were following state orders, by the mid-1960s, we start to see a questioning of how even everyday choices, and in the book, I also discuss even acts of kindness, for example, taking an act to shelter a neighbor or offering food might actually have contributed to the tragedy. For example, you might have someone might have looked to shelter a neighbor, and then in somehow so doing, it might have exposed that person to the law. The import of bystander research is, to me, it's at the same time, it's disheartening and hopeful. It exists because in some ways we think the worst of people, but bystander research also believes or advocates that through interventions, we can train people to act better.
Right. And, you know, even around the Holocaust, there are trajectories of historiography, and that, I believe it was in the 90s, there was a work by Daniel Goldhagen, Hitler's Willing Executioners, making the argument about the complicity of the general German population. And then there was a backlash by other scholars saying that the arguments were problematic. And so, in a sense, ebbs and flows of a certain outlook about that presumption of humans' capacity to do harm, you know, something that you refer to the book as the kind of notion that we're all Nazis in waiting. One of the key moments in the development of a pretty pessimistic notion of human nature around complicity and bystanders was the 1964 killing of Kitty Genovese, who was stabbed outside of her apartment in New York. And it was reported in the New York Times that 38 uncaring bystanders did nothing while hearing her being murdered. This became a pivotal example of the heartlessness of bystanders and some presumption about humans, and, you know, it was taught in psychology textbooks from then on. Why do you write about that killing as actually being a problematic moment in understanding complicity?
So, you know, my re-examination of this case is certainly not new. As you mentioned, there are some really excellent articles and books that revisit the Genovese case and point out discrepancies in that narrative of the 38 witnesses. I'm thinking of a work by Joseph DeMay, who's a historian, and a journalist, Peter Barker. As you mentioned, at the time, the New York Times reported in 1964 that 38 of Genovese's neighbors watched the scene unfold but failed to intervene. And then later on, a reporter, Loudon Wainwright, writes for Life magazine that the witnesses crouching in darkened windows were like watchers of a late show, looking on until the play had passed from their view. And in that article, he laments that we are becoming a callous, chicken-hearted, and immoral people. I chose to discuss the example of this case because I think it shows several things that are contributing to this complicity moment. First and foremost, something I see is the human tendency to think the worst of one another. This case and the coverage of it are arising in the world of 1964, in the aftermath of World War II, in the midst of ongoing civil rights protests, when the public is at a time, perhaps not unlike today, when there's a lot of uncertainty about the future and a lack of faith in systems and one another. When you look closely at this case, however, the narrative that is in the media at the time turns out to be very flawed. And it turns out to be true that multiple people tried to help the victim in the ways they felt they could. At least two people called the police, for example. And one woman, Sophia Farrar, as soon as she heard the attacker leave, ran downstairs in the dark and held Genovese until the police arrived, which at the time was not promptly, because I think when we view this case through the lens of hindsight, we tend to think of the law as functioning as it does today. But in 1964, there was no 911 system. The 911 system was established partly as a result of cases like this. A story I really love that emerges out of this tragic narrative is the story of how Genovese's killer, Mosley, was actually apprehended. Mosley was apprehended not due to police investigation, but totally by chance, after being caught red-handed during a burglary about a week after the killing occurred. A man had spotted Mosley taking a television out of a neighborhood home and putting it in his car. He didn't recognize Mosley, so he stopped and intervened and questioned him. He doubted Mosley's answer that he was actually helping a neighbor move, so the Good Samaritan called a friend. And together the two took action. They disabled Mosley's car and they called the police. My bachelor's degree is in English literature, and so I'm always interested in narrative. What happens if you start telling a story from a different place or a different perspective? And this really makes me think, how might society look different if we were to start from the perspective of these Good Samaritan neighbors instead of the heartless bystanders? Another thing I think we can really take from the Genovese case, which is perhaps a less optimistic perspective, is that all of our points of view as human beings are limited by our lived experience and our circumstance. In the Genovese case, the witnesses' points of view were quite literally limited. Joseph DeMay, the historian I mentioned, who did extensive research into the case and Genovese's life and death, notes that she did experience not one but two attacks on the night of her murder. The first attack was a brief assault that was actually thwarted when a neighbor intervened by yelling out. The second more sustained attack that was fatal took place indoors at the back of the apartment building, which was a location outside of most residents' line of vision. Most people who had seen the first attack reported seeing the victim get up and walk away. An equally important limitation I talk about is that we're all a product of our times. The bystanders of 1960 did not have the same capacity to identify that a crime was happening as we would today. It's an understatement to say that the criminal justice system of the time was hostile to women victims, especially women like Kitty Genovese, who worked in bars and might have been returning home unescorted late at night. When crimes happened to these, and I use this in quotes, types of women, right? Assumptions about the victim's complicity in their own harm often operated to cast doubt on their veracity and to protect perpetrators from accountability. So neighbors who actually did see Mosley's first attack that night might have thought they witnessed a violent encounter, but after the encounter, the woman would have gotten to her feet and walked away. And reports of the time with interviews of witnesses report that they did hear a woman yelling, but assumed it was a lover's quarrel. Most did not, in the lens of 1964, read the attack as an attempted rape, attempted murder by a stranger. These statements reflect a time in which rape was significantly underreported and underprosecuted. Marital rape was legal, and the attitude of law enforcement towards domestic disputes would have generally been to turn a blind eye. It's not until the 1970s when we start to see rape shield laws, for example, that protect victims from attacks on credibility. The response of Genovese's neighbors, I think, demonstrate that the human capacity for making social change is a product of the historical moment that we inhabit.
Legal scholar Francine Banner is my guest. We're discussing her book, Beyond Complicity, Why We Blame Each Other Instead of Systems. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, then thinking about how earlier notions of complicity in the 20th century have shaped complicity now in a moment, which, as you describe it, is one of, well, obviously tremendous crisis and flux, but you also see it as a moment with possibilities, which we'll get into further. But I wanted to ask you, taking things to the present, you argue that one of the ways that complicity operates and perhaps gets some of its power is that so many of the crises that we experience seem murky in terms of saying we have a clear perpetrator on one side and we have a clear victim on another. Global warming being one example, especially for those of us in the global north. Can you talk about that murkiness more broadly, this contemporary notion of complicity?
Sure. So in the book, I use several examples to talk about this, examples of racism, examples of sexism and sexual harassment in the context of the Me Too movement. And as you mentioned, climate change to talk about both what I identify as perhaps positive connective aspects of complicity, causing us to rethink relationships with the world and what obligation do we owe one another. And then it's more isolating and stigmatizing effects. And I think it's easy to become disheartened when we read the news because the negative of complicity is often on display. But exploring complicity across these contexts, I think, can give us some hope, too. An example I would actually talk about is the Me Too movement. And specifically, if we think about perpetrators Harvey Weinstein, who the New York Times at one point described as having built a complicity machine out of the witting, the unwitting, and those in between. And Jeffrey Epstein, for example. In each of these cases, there are going to be the people that clearly knew, in the commonly understood sense of the world, about predation, or who acted like ostriches, who hid their heads in the sand to avoid the obvious. Adjacent to these deliberate bad actors are going to be those that covered up or concealed. So if we think more broadly, we might see in the context of sexual assault and harassment, bishops and religious organizations who ignore reports of abuse, or military higher-ups who demote complainants and promote harassers, university administrators who we see deliberately ignoring or minimizing complaints. But the conversations about complicity in the cases of Weinstein and Epstein were much broader. There are countless individuals in each of these cases whose implication is less clear and who are sorting through different ways in which they personally could have enabled toxic cultures or behaviors. Even victims have been reckoning with the ways in which they may have been complicit. For example, actor Uma Thurman gave a statement to the New York Times where she described encounters with Weinstein that sounded more like a confession than the narrative of a survivor. Thurman discloses that she was harassed by the producer, but the bulk of her statement is devoted to conveying regret that her choice to remain silent contributed to what she calls a cloud cover, encouraging lambs to walk to the slaughter. In various conversations about the entertainment complicity machine, we can see various aspects of complicity in thinking through what obligations we may have to each other. In the conversations, we can definitely see the negative aspects of complicity. For example, we see often social condemnation of and then rushed or canned apologies by celebrities or influencers that raise important questions about moral accountability. How much must a person have known before to warrant an apology now? We've gotten to the point where apologies really present a problem of normative dilution. When wrongdoing occurs, behavioral norms demand that the wrongdoer apologizes. Yet we live in a culture where we're glutted with apologies, so we've begun to really doubt their sincerity. And then this cycle of apology starts to become tautological. The more apologies we demand, the fewer of them we believe, and the less likely we are to forgive. As I mentioned, also, another issue is that once a person is labeled complicit, the road to reform becomes less than clear. While in a traditional liability model of punishment, we would just identify a perpetrator and mete out culpability proportional to the level of harm they caused, a forward-looking model of liability becomes more complicated. Complicity doesn't really provide a means for rehabilitation or a path for accused people to extract themselves from the web of accountability. Some people seem to bounce back. Other people seem to be more popular than ever after facing cancellation. Something that's relevant across issues, from Me Too and sexual harassment to racism to climate change, is that imagining a more just future often entails a recognition of our own contribution to issues in the past. Quick on the heels of spotting any problem is often the comprehension that we ourselves have been likely part of the problem. And I talk about this in the context of Me Too by looking at the accusations that were faced in 2018 by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo, whose gubernatorial campaign was backed by Planned Parenthood and the National Organization for Women. When accusations were waged against Cuomo, voters really faced a conundrum. Because Cuomo had ostensibly seemed very supportive and had dedicated a lot of his agenda to women's issues. Voters were faced with confronting a question of whether Cuomo, who was tweeting things like "believe survivors" in the context of Me Too, was genuinely committed to gender equality, or whether this all may have been a ruse to conceal abusive behavior. A hard thing is that in examining complicity, people who were considering whether they or others had been enablers were largely from within Democratic and liberal sectors. And it turns out that deeply examining complicity often reveals layers of where individuals may not necessarily have been practicing what they preached. A problem with complicity is that once we start to investigate it, there's rarely an end to it.
Francine Banner is my guest. She's professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn, and we're discussing her book, Beyond Complicity, Why We Blame Each Other Instead of Systems. I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, let's talk about complicity and the law, because obviously it is a legal concept as it plays out in civil and criminal law, and we've been talking a lot about its political, philosophical meaning. But I wonder if you could tell us how it works within the law and who tends to be at the short end of the stick.
Sure. So my interest in complicity comes in part from teaching criminal law. And I find accomplice laws particularly fascinating because while most criminal laws demand proof of every element beyond a reasonable doubt, accomplice cases are an outlier. Perpetrators can receive very harsh sentences for crimes in which they provided relatively little help, or be punished for events that they didn't really want to happen. I've taught for many years in the Michigan prison system. I have taught incarcerated students in both men's and women's facilities. And many of my students have been juvenile lifers, individuals who've been sentenced to life in prison as teens for playing relatively minor roles, a lookout, a scout, a getaway driver in violent felonies. Many of my women students share stories of coming into the system for roles of helping. So helping a partner, a boyfriend or husband to commit crime, or failing to intervene when a partner is abusing children. In criminal law, accomplice charges can be very harsh and they're very common. When we think about legal complicity, the word accessory might come to mind. At its inception in the 1700s, there were four categories of felony accomplice, and each of these carried a different penalty, depending on the extent to which someone was involved in a crime. Today, most U.S. and federal criminal codes do away with these distinctions, and they determine guilt based on whether a person knew about a crime before or knew about a crime after it happened. Accessories after the fact, who might have helped conceal evidence or misled the police during an investigation, may receive a lesser penalty or be subject to a lesser charge. But generally speaking, a person who provides assistance before a crime or during a crime, no matter how minor, can be convicted as an accomplice. And then if found guilty, the helper is convicted or can be convicted of the same offense and can face the same punishment as the principal actor. In the United States, in many U.S. states, this is compounded by the application of what's known as the felony murder rule. It differs by state, but in general, the rule means that a defendant can be charged with murder if a death takes place in the course of an underlying felony, such as a burglary, a kidnapping, or rape. When you put together accomplice liability and felony murder, this can mean that a defendant is facing a very long sentence for a relatively small role in a crime, for example, a lookout or a driver. In the book, I discuss a number of accomplice cases. In one case, for example, the defendant was waiting in the car while his friend went in unarmed into a local bar to stage a holdup. During the robbery, there was some sort of struggle. The store owner pulled a gun and the friend grabbed the gun. The friend used extremely bad judgment and led the police on a foot chase and then used the gun to shoot a police officer. And the defendant, who was waiting in the car and thought he was engaging in an unarmed robbery, was convicted of homicide. Criminal law, generally speaking, has a big three elements that prosecutors need to prove beyond a reasonable doubt: intent, voluntary action, and causation. The defendant has to have done something to cause the crime. And I argue that complicity falls short in each of these categories. Take the example of knowledge. Complicity is what we call a specific intent crime, which means that to be convicted of complicity, a defendant must have intended two things. First, that the outcome happen, and then second, to have helped to bring about that outcome. The questions that come up in the criminal law are really similar to those we're thinking about in society, as we consider, for example, how much helping is enough for somebody to be considered complicit in causing some kind of wrongdoing or harm. The trend today is for courts to separate the analysis of the intents required for complicity. So the defendant has to have known in the everyday sense they were giving assistance to the perpetrator. So we have to have known we were helping. But we need not have been certain in practical terms that the outcome would occur. So while a person would not be guilty for example, wholly innocently lending a fellow skier a mask that is later used in a completely unforeseen holdup, a skier who lends a mask to a friend that he knows could be a burglar could potentially be held accountable as complicit. In the application, you can see how this would be less than straightforward. Complicity also raises issues in terms of causation. One might think responsibility for causing a harm should be parceled out proportionally, that we might look at a completed crime like a pie, and then maybe each defendant's guilt should be related to their piece of that criminal pie, with the accomplice that provided a lot of help, for example, a safe cracker in a heist type situation, receiving a big penalty, and someone who, for example, drove a van for a number of robbers, receiving a smaller one. But that's not how accomplice liability works. In terms of accomplice liability, the law treats a bit player who held the door open for someone the same as the computer genius who cracked the code to get into the vault. Courts tend to use language like team player and co-venturer. The shortcomings of accomplice law put complicity in the category of what law professor Paul Robinson refers to as an inculpating crime. It's a crime that allows for convicting a defendant without the prosecution necessarily proving every element beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not unusual to see inculpating crimes. We allow juries to overlook intent requirements quite frequently. For example, if a defendant commits a crime while they're drunk or high, as long as the defendant created the situation of their own free will, even if they could not form the mental state required at the time of the crime, we may overlook that. Strict liability crimes like speeding require no intent of proof whatsoever. But when we combine accomplice liability with something like the felony murder doctrine, which assumes that someone who had the intent to commit a violent crime, like a burglary or robbery, also had the required intent for murder, this can be a big leap.
You're making the argument, Francine Banner, that complicity has these different facets, right? You've just been describing its legal side and the real messiness, and let's just say injustice, that takes place, which the poor people of color are the people most likely to bear. And you've also been describing how complicity is used more politically, and that on the one hand, you see a usefulness to it in that it can highlight the role of institutions and their connections to larger systemic problems in the world, and ways that also it can be not particularly useful in shaming individuals for their actions or actually often inaction. Do you see on some level a parallel between the way the criminal system works, coming down hard on accomplices, and the way complicity operates politically or socially in casting people out for their infractions, that in both of them, there is a very strong punitive dimension, really one that eschews the possibility for rehabilitation or redemption. As you note, there is no antonym or opposite of complicity. Once you're complicit, it's virtually impossible to extricate yourself from whatever your misdeeds were.
I do. I see strong similarities. And I take the position, certainly, that law and we were talking about specifically criminal law, but this is true of civil law as well, is deeply embedded in and reflects society. And, you know, the criminal law is really the most visible, significant arm of enforcing the will of the state. And so the ways in which that the law approaches decision-making, I think, often mirror the conversations that we're having in larger discourse. Legal philosopher Christopher Cutts uses the term inchoate, meaning unformed, to talk about the ways in which the law approaches complicity today. The idea is that underlying contemporary applications of accomplice liability is what you mentioned, the idea that we're punishing people for the risk they're creating by, in some ways, guilt by associations, rather than a bad outcome that they, in fact, we can know that they participated directly in. And this distrust of motivation of human nature and this sense of personal responsibility are, you know, I think deeply, deeply embedded in U.S. society and certainly within the U.S. criminal justice system, but also in the rhetoric we have around us. So when we think back, connecting back to conversations around risk and even thinking about the COVID-19 pandemic, when we face risks, quite often we tend to attribute responsibility for handling them to individuals. If we think about campaigns around all kinds of things, alcohol consumption, cigarettes, we can see a strong, strong discourse that builds on this U.S. idea of personal accountability, drink responsibly, gamble responsibly, make good decisions. And certainly, you know, we can all think about COVID. And, you know, I'm sure I wasn't the only person going online to figure out, you know, what's the risk level today? Should I send my child back to in-person school? And then later, as the pandemic has waned and ebbed and flowed, you know, is this a time when I really should be wearing a mask in public? How bad is the virus? And, you know, we are given information, but many of us are left to our own devices. And, you know, we can see in the language of the pandemic, for example, terms like quarantiner or COVIDiot, or at one point even couch patriot for those people that, you know, did the quote unquote good thing and stayed home. The extent to which we are relying on this discourse of individual and personal responsibility, and we're attributing motivation to individuals for bad decision making and bad behavior, rather than really looking at, you know, if we shift back to the criminal law, rather than really looking at what happened, what's the proportion of the role they played in the crime, we're looking back at, you know, what was their accountability for the poor choices that they made? And I do situate this in the context of other crimes as well. I look at conspiracy. I look at attempt. These are actually called inchoate crimes in the law. Complicity actually is not under the subheading inchoate. Complicity is supposed to be looking more at the action rather than the potential of harm. But a crime like attempt looks at, you know, how likely is it that someone was going to complete this bad act? Attempt brings up questions of when can we intervene? And if we look at the law of attempt, legal cases are allowing for earlier and earlier intervention to avert potential bad acts. And I think within both law and society, we see with complicity this questioning of motivation and this identification of a potential for bad acts to happen. In the context, as we're facing risks, more and more risks in society, I think that's perhaps understandable. I think the more and greater the potential of harm, the sooner that we want to stop that, and the more skeptical we tend to be of other people.
As you just noted, focusing on individual choices, responsibility has deep roots in American society, but it could be argued that since the 1970s, you know, and 80s in the neoliberal era, that has been intensified. It can lead one to the conclusion that a focus on the action of individuals can often lose focus on a more systemic critique, a structural critique. And I wanted to ask you for your take on the waxing and waning of social movements, of collective action versus individual action in accentuating this more individualistic notion of complicity. Social movements do rise and fall. And after the 1960s, in the 1970s, after the upsurge of the 60s, there was a turn often for people to look, at least within social movements, inward on the left at a point where it seemed changing society had kind of hit a wall. And again, obviously, we saw the fluorescence of social movements around the killing of George Floyd, and then again the waning of those movements. Do you see the rise and fall of social movements and the sort of the obstacles they run into as playing a role in their retreat, creating the space for an increased focus on individual responsibility?
So I'll start this way, and hopefully I'll get to your answer. One thing I talk about in terms of tracing the history of complicity is that I look at some adjacent terms, and one of the terms I look at is the idea of the enabler. And I think it's interesting to observe that I believe most people today would hear the term enabler and, generally speaking, think of it as a pejorative term. But this understanding of the term is new. This present-day use of the term I talk about in the book really evolved in the 1990s. At the same time, there is a therapeutic field and literature emerging around the context of addiction. In a 1991 column, William Safire identified that enabling was a keyword and wrote, "Empowering is out and enabling is in." He described that that word had taken a turn from talking about the promotion of positive goods, which it had been used up to that point, to describing facilitation of social ills. And, you know, in thinking through this book, one of the things I consider is the idea of going back to, and in some ways reclaiming, this idea of enabling as a positive good, and thinking about future actions as potentially being motivated not by a moral guilt or shame for actions done in the past, but how do we move past that to carefully rethinking our role in the future and crafting the future? And that becomes even more challenging when we're talking about dismantling systems, not simply putting a Band-Aid on something, but really taking a hard look and at institutions and even at something like criminal law itself, and questioning the foundations on which our society is built. And when, as we're doing this, there's a fear that even the smallest of our actions may have caused harm or may be causing harm to someone else. And this can be paralyzing. So we see even new psychological disorders emerging, for example, eco-anxiety, a fear of contributing to climate change or global warming, that are stemming from what is really an inability to make personal decisions or collective action decisions in the face of what seem like overwhelming risks, and not 100%. I talk about us as being on the precipice of something as a society and not necessarily knowing where we'll go in the future. And there's a concern that our actions might foster future harms that can really stop us from doing what good we can do in the present. And this is really fueled by the media, who focus on growing political polarization during this upcoming election year that is certainly only going to become worse. This focus on division, I think, really doesn't pay sufficient attention to the ways in which our moral circles really are growing. And it's, I do offer many examples in the book of resistance and challenges to the movement forward that we've seen in social movements, be it movements in favor of different climate reforms, Black Lives Matter, or movements stemming from Me Too. But, you know, I do want to challenge that a little bit, because we are really experiencing what I identify as a lot of change and positive change within a very short space of time. And so, you know, I think I'll admittedly say I'm an optimist. After many years of teaching in prison systems, I will admittedly say that my approach to life is always that, you know, we're bigger than our worst act. And, you know, I think I wholeheartedly embrace the critique that I may be more optimistic than other people may feel in this moment. But I guess I would like to identify myself as a pragmatic optimist. And with that, I just want to end, I think, with a hopeful story. And that's that in 2016, you might recall, janitor Corey Menefee was fired for breaking a window that depicted the system of enslavement at Yale University. Menefee was a dishwasher, and he broke a window pane that featured a scene on a plantation. The window had been in the dining hall of Calhoun College, where Menefee worked, for more than a century. The college was named for John C. Calhoun, who was a U.S. vice president who was an ardent proponent of slavery. For more than 100 years, students, staff, faculty socialized in the shadow of that window and rarely acknowledged its presence. But as we now know, we were profoundly being influenced by the imagery of objects and monuments like that window. At the time, Menefee justified his action with a very pragmatic observation. It's the 21st century. Why do I have to go to work and look at this? The university's initial response to Menefee, and this is 2016, was not affirming. He was arrested, He was charged with a felony. His act was categorized as vandalism. Yale agreed to drop the charges, but only after Menifee resigned and apologized. And the institution insisted that Menifee sign an NDA that silenced his ability to speak about the incident. Years later, the institution's response, right, just a few years later, the institution's response, and particularly the demand that Menifee apologize and not speak about this gesture of defiance, I think seem unfathomable to many of us. In this very short period of time, we've seen buildings renamed, crimes are being recategorized, the NDA system, the web of NDAs within corporations and institutions are being challenged. There's even an amendment being added to the IRS code disallowing corporate tax deductions for payments that are made relating to sexual misconduct if the payment is made subject to a non-disclosure agreement, a provision that's widely referred to as the Weinstein tax. I feel like we can easily become disheartened in this current social and political moment. And there is certainly a lot to work against and to be disillusioned by. But I think the Menifee example provides just one example that we are really on the visible edge of identifying a web of intersections between individuals and institutions. And in thinking through responsibility and connections to each other in a really new way. And I feel like it sounds trite, but rather than the beginning of an end, I really think complicity can signal the end of a beginning.
And in fact, that's a key part of the book, that we're in a tipping point. Francine Banner, thank you so much for joining me.
You're very welcome.
Francine Banner is a legal scholar. She's professor of sociology at the University of Michigan, Dearborn. We've been discussing Beyond Complicity, Why We Blame Each Other Instead of Systems, which is published by UC Press at againstthegrain.org. You can find a link to that book. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.